read like a map of her teenage firsts. The balcony where she'd first smoked weed, hacking into the beach air. The corner of the kitchen where she'd broken up with her first boyfriend. The hallway in front of the bathroom where she had drunk cried the weekend after they buried her mother. She hadn't been back to Cody's since. The yellow house already felt like something she'd outgrown, and once she'd graduated, she promised herself that she would never return. She had always been bothered by how many people did, how everyone seemed stuck in time, the years since high school collapsing as soon as they stepped through the door. Still, Cody's house was the only place she could think to find Luke, after she'd driven past his parents' house and seen his truck missing from the driveway. Somehow, she knew he would be at Cody's. She felt him as she walked, lovesick and angry, across the damp beach sand. She followed the footprint trail leading to the beach house, wondering if she might find the footprints that belonged to Luke, her feet stepping inside his the entire time. Techno pulsed through the open door in green waves as she padded up the lopsided driftwood steps. Bass rumbled through wooden floors sticky with beer, and she paused in the doorway, her eyes adjusting to the dimness. She wouldn't have noticed Luke at first if it weren't for his walk. Past the crowd of white kids thrashing together, past kitchen counters covered in half-empty bottles of liquor, and two triangles of cups from an abandoned game of beer pong, she caught Luke's silhouette crossing the darkened room. That slight limp, subtle enough for most to ignore it, but as familiar to her as his voice. He looked drunk, a near-empty pint of Jim Beam dangling from his hand. When she neared, he swayed a little, as if the sight of her was enough to knock him off balance.
"Nadia," he said, "what are you doing here?"
"What the fuck are you doing here?" she said. "I called you 100 fucking times. You shouldn't be here. You should be in bed or something. Where were you?" she said. "I waited for hours. Some shit came up, okay? I knew you were gonna find a way home." But he stared at the ground when he said it, and she knew he was lying.
"You left me," she said.
He finally looked up at her, and it startled her how he looked the same as he always had. Shouldn't someone look different once you've caught them in a lie? Once you've seen them truthfully for the first time?
"Look, this shit was supposed to be fun," he said. "Not all this fucking drama. I got you the money. What else do you want from me?"
Then he brushed past her, pushing through the crowd and lurching unevenly toward the door. She should have known. She should have known when he'd brought her an envelope with $600 that the money was his part, the rest hers. He'd slipped her the money, and now she was a problem that he'd already dealt with. In a way, she had known this, or at least suspected it. But she'd wanted to believe in Luke, in love, in people who did not leave. She squeezed into the kitchen past a group of giddy high schoolers playing flip cup and reached for a bottle of Jose Cuervo on the counter. The dreadlocked nurse had told her no alcohol for 48 hours. Thins the blood, increases the bleeding. But she poured a shot of tequila anyway. She felt a hand on her waist, and when she turned, Devin Jackson lingered behind her, a joint pressed between his fingertips. She hadn't spoken to him since they fooled around once her freshman year. He looked the same, almost delicate, tall and lean with long eyelashes, except his skin was now covered in tattoos. Even his neck was darkened with ink, a fleur-de-lis stretching up his throat.
"Jesus," she said. You're stained now. He laughed. Where the fuck you been? Nowhere. Everywhere. He passed her the joint, and she felt 15 again, smoking with the boy who had fingered her once at the top of a Ferris wheel, gently, the car swaying like it was rocking them to sleep. The last she'd heard, Devin was modeling now, mostly on gay websites. 2 years ago, a friend had sent her a link to a photo spread where Devin stretched out along white sheets in nothing but his briefs, a blonde man's face inches from his crotch. I heard you're famous now, she said, passing the joint. She didn't mean to get drunk. She poured herself another drink because Devin asked why her cup was empty. What, did she become a nun or something? She poured a shot of tequila into a cup of lemonade, then another shot, then another. Then she let Devin pull her onto the dance floor. Not because she wanted to dance, but because dancing was an excuse to be close, to touch, to be comforted by the press and pull of Devin's body against hers without having to talk. And the drinks made her feel nice. Although the room was warm and she felt disgusted by Devin's swampy t-shirt as she draped an arm around his waist. Her blood was probably thinning as she danced. But how nice it was to feel drunk and relaxed and warm and touched and touching. Devin kissed her neck, squeezing her ass with both hands. You're so fucking fine, he said, breath hot against her ear. He grinded against her, biting his lip in that serious way of anyone trying hard to be sexy. She giggled. He laughed, too, squeezing her again. What? He said. I thought you liked boys now, she said. Who the fuck told you that? People. Does this feel like I like boys? He pressed her hand against his bulge, and she wrested her wrist out of his grasp, pushing him away. She felt trapped suddenly, like she was suffocating. Blurry-eyed, she felt along the wall, past bodies bumping into her, the frenetic rhythms pumping out the speakers, through the sticky humidity to the back door. On the other end of the balcony, Cody Richardson leaned against the wooden railing. He was taller, thinner now, his dirty blonde hair shaggier, his plaid shirt hanging off his angular shoulders. He smiled, flashing his silver lip ring, and she eased toward him, gripping the rail. Don't you think it's weird? He said. What? He pointed over her shoulder. Beyond the lavender roofs of other beach houses, she could see the top of the San Onofre nuclear power plant, two white domes that kids on the school bus used to call the boobs when they drove past on field trips. Any minute, boom! Cody's eyes widened, his hands exploding away from each other. Just like that. I mean, all it takes is a storm and we all blow up. Nadia rested her head on the railing, closing her eyes. That's how I want to go someday, she said. Really? Boom. This is how she imagined it. Her mother driving around town, her husband's service pistol in her lap. A curve, then another curve. The morning light as pink as a baby girl's nightgown. She was groggy, or maybe clear-headed, as clear as she'd ever been. She thought first about driving to the beach, because it'd be a good place to die. Warm enough. A dying place ought to be warm. Enough coldness waiting in the afterlife. But it was too late. Surfers were already padding across the sand, and dying should be private, like humming a little song only you can hear. So she drove on, half a mile up the hill from Upper Room, where her car was shielded by branches. She shut off her engine and picked up the gun. She had never shot anything before, but she'd seen animals die, pigs squealing as they bled out, chickens flapping as her mother wrung their necks. You could coax out life, or you could end it at once. A slow death might seem gentler, but a sudden death was kinder. Merciful, even. She would be merciful to herself, this once. When her father asked, Nadia told him she hadn't seen the tree. In the darkness, the tree in front of their house was nearly impossible to see, so she'd made too sharp a turn. It was nearly 4 a.m., and they were both standing in the driveway, her father in his green plaid robe and slippers, her leaning against the truck door, her shoes in her hands. She had planned to sneak back inside the house, but her father had run outside as soon as he heard the crash. Now he crouched in front of his dented bumper, feeling the jagged metal.
"Why the heck weren't your headlights on?" he said.
"They were," she said. I looked down to shut them off, and then I looked up, and then the tree." She swayed a little. Her father frowned, straightening.
"Are you drunk?"
he said.
"No,"
she said.
"I can smell it on you from here."
"No."
"And you drove home?"
He stepped toward her, and the sudden movement made her drop everything in her hands, her purse and shoes and keys clattering to the driveway. She jutted her arms out before he could come closer. He stopped, his jaw clenched, and she couldn't tell whether he wanted to slap her or hug her. Both hurt, his anger and his love. As they stood together in the dark driveway, his heart beating against her hands. Chapter 3. We pray. Not without ceasing, as Paul instructs, but often enough. On Sundays and Wednesdays, we gather in the prayer room and slip off jackets, leave shoes at the door, and walk around in stocking feet, sliding a little, like girls playing on waxed floors. We sit in a ring of white chairs in the center of the room, and one of us reaches into the wooden box by the door, stuffed with prayer request cards. Then we pray. For Earl Vernon, who wants his crackhead daughter to come home. Cindy Harris's husband, who is leaving her because he'd caught her sending nasty photographs to her boss. Tracy Robinson, who has taken to drinking again, hard liquor at that. Saul Young, who is struggling to help his wife through the final days of her dementia. We read the request cards and we pray for new jobs, new houses, new husbands, better health, better behaved children, more faith, more patience, less temptation. We don't think of ourselves as prayer warriors. A man must have come up with that term. Men think anything difficult is war. But prayer is more delicate than battle, especially intercessory prayer. More than just a notion, taking up the burdens of someone else, often someone you don't even know. You close your eyes and listen to a request. Then you have to slip inside their body. You are Tracy Robinson, burning for whiskey. You are Cindy Harris's husband, searching your wife's phone. You are Earl Vernon, washing dirty knots out of your strung-out daughter's hair. If you don't become them, even for a second, a prayer is nothing but words. That's why it didn't take us long to figure out what had happened to Robert Turner's truck. Ordinarily waxed and gleaming, the truck hobbled into the upper room parking lot on Sunday with a dented front bumper and cracked headlight. In the lobby, we heard young folks joking about how drunk Nadia Turner had been at some beach party. Then we became young again. Or that is to say, we became her. Dancing all night with a bottle of vodka in hand, staggering out the door. A careless drive home weaving between lanes. The crunch of metal. How, when Robert smelled the liquor, he must have hit her or maybe hugged her. How she was probably deserving of both. The truck was the first sign that something wasn't right that summer, but none of us saw it that way. The banged-up truck only meant one thing to us then. Look what she done. Who done? That Turner girl. Which one is that? You know the one. Red bone, clear eyes like, oh, that girl. What other Turner girl is there? Don't she look, sure do, like she spit her out? Y'all see his? Mm-hmm. How much you think that costs to fix? Why she do that? She wild. Oh, Robert. She wild, wild. We only felt sorry for Robert Turner. He'd already been through too much. Half a year earlier, his wife had stolen his gun and blown her head clean off her body. A little past sunrise, she'd parked her blue Tercel along some back road and sent her car rocking from the gun blast. A jogger had found her an hour later. Robert had driven the Tercel home from the police station, the headrest still darkened with his wife's blood. No one knew what had happened to that car. Rumor was that after combing it for the rest of his wife's things, her pocketbook, overdue library paperbacks, a ruby red hair clip he'd bought her years ago from Mexico, he'd put a brick on the gas pedal and sent it right into the San Luis Rey River. But a man as sensible as Robert had probably sold it for parts. And sometimes, we wondered if a passing car had Elise Turner's muffler, if her turn signal blinked at us from the next lane. All of that, and now a reckless daughter, too. No wonder Robert looked so troubled. That evening, we found a prayer card with his name on it in the wooden box outside the door. In the center, in all lowercase, the words, pray for her. We didn't know which her he meant, his dead wife or his reckless daughter, so we prayed for both. It's more than just a notion, you know, praying for someone dead. When there's nobody to slip into, you can only try to find their spirit. And who wants to chase down Elise Turner's, wherever it's hiding? Later that night, when we left the prayer room, we felt something in upper room shift. Couldn't explain it. Something just felt different. Off. We knew the walls of upper room like the walls of our own homes. We'd soft-stepped down hallways as the choir practiced, noticing that corner in front of the instrument closet where the paint had chipped, or the tile in the ladies' room that had been laid crooked. We'd spent decades studying the splotch that looked like an elephant's ear on the ceiling above the water fountain. And we knew the exact spot on the sanctuary carpet where Elise Turner had knelt the night before she killed herself. The more spiritual of us even swore they could still see the indented curve from her knees. Sometimes we joked that when we died, we'd all become part of these walls, pressed down flat like wallpaper. Near the stained glass windows in the sanctuary, or in a corner of the Sunday school room, or even attached to the ceiling in the prayer room, where we met every Sunday and Wednesday to intercede. We didn't know then that the banged-up truck had knotted Nadia Turner's future to our own, that we would watch her come and go over the years, each time tugging that knot a little tighter. On Sunday night, the Turners received a visitor. Nadia had spent most of the weekend in bed, not because her stomach still hurt, but because she had nowhere else to go. She wasn't pregnant anymore, but she had wrecked her father's truck. What if it took weeks to fix? How would he stand it? No truck to turn to, no errands to run, only work and home. He loved one thing, her father, and she had ruined it. Worse, her father hadn't even yelled at her. She wished he would rage when he was angry. It'd be easier that way, quicker. But instead, he coiled up tight inside himself, moving silently around her in the kitchen or avoiding her altogether. She felt herself disappearing into the silence until she heard two high-pitched notes stepping through the air. So light, she thought she dreamed them. Then she heard three knocks, and a brief stab ran through her. Luke. She jumped up, finger combing her hair into a ponytail, tucking her bra strap under her tank top, adjusting her shorts. She padded barefoot across the cold tile and opened the door. "Oh," she said. "Hi." Pastor Shepherd smiled from the doorstep. She had never seen him look this casual before, not in his church robes or three-piece suit, but a polo shirt and jeans and black sneakers with special soles he wore, Luke said, because his knees were bad. She'd always imagined pastors as mousy old men in sweaters and glasses, but Pastor Shepherd looked more like the bouncers she sweet-talked outside of clubs, tall and wide, his shiny mahogany head nearly touching the doorframe. He seemed even larger on Sunday mornings, stalking across the altar in his long black robe, his voice booming to the rafters. But in his polo shirt, standing on her front steps, he looked relaxed, kind even. He smiled at her, and she saw Luke for a second, a fragment of him, like a vein of light through smashed glass.
"Hi, honey," the pastor said. "Is your dad around?"
"In the yard."
She backed up, letting him inside. He filled the entrance, gazing around the living room, and she wondered what he made of her house. He probably visited so many homes, he could read them as soon as he stepped inside. Some houses filled with sickness, some with sin, others with sorrow. But hers? It probably just seemed empty. The silent, uncluttered rooms, the whole house open like a wound that would never scab over. She led the pastor to the backyard, where her father was bench-pressing on the concrete slab. He racked his weights with a loud clink.
"Pastor!"
He wiped his face with his gray USMC t-shirt. "Didn't know you were stopping by." She slid the screen door shut and started back down the hallway. As she turned, she felt the pastor watching her, and she wondered for a second if he knew. Maybe his calling had imbued him with divine knowledge, and he could see it hanging off her shoulders, the heaviness of her secrets. Or even if he had no holy power, maybe he just sensed it. Maybe he could feel the once connection between the two of them, and as soon as she'd turned, he'd reached up to touch its frayed edges. She tiptoed down the hall to the bathroom and perched on the toilet lid, listening through the cracked window.
"I was in the area," the pastor was saying. "Saw your truck earlier. Everything okay?"
"It'll be fine," her father said. "Just needs a little bodywork. Sorry about the picnic. I know I said I'd haul those chairs."
"We'll manage."
The pastor paused.
"Folks are saying your girl crashed it."
She gripped her knees tighter on the toilet lid.
"Were we that crazy when we were young?" her father said.
"Crazier, maybe. She okay?"
"She's a smart girl," her father said. "A lot smarter than me, that's for sure. Going off to college soon. She should know better. That's what worries me."
"You know how these kids are. They just want to push the limits. Think they're invincible."
"She wasn't like this before," her father said. "Or maybe she was. Maybe I just didn't know her before. Elise was always there, too. They were so close. I couldn't get between them and didn't hardly want to. Mothers are selfish. You know she wouldn't even let me hold Nadia at first. Not until the doctor made her rest. You can't get between no mother and child." "I don't know, Pastor. I'm trying to raise her right. Maybe I just don't know how."
She eased back down the hallway. She didn't want to hear more. She hated hearing her father blame himself for her mistakes, even though she knew she blamed him too. After all, she had been the one who held it together. She'd answered the door when the mothers visited with food, while her father disappeared into the darkness of his bedroom. She had eaten the food the mothers brought until she sickened of it, until she felt she could taste exactly who'd made what. Mother Hattie had brought the macaroni and cheese, so rich that butter pulled in the corner of the pan. Mother Agnes, rail thin, had made the apple pie, its lattices straight and ruler made. For weeks, Nadia ate donated food, each bite soured by grief, until she grew tired of the old ladies, their kindly smiles masks for nosiness. So one day, she left their dishes on the front steps and ignored the doorbell. Then she drove her father's truck to the grocery store, and for dinner, she cooked meatloaf. It came out dry and brick-like, suspended in a pan of brown gel. But her father ate it anyway. After the pastor left, she carried her mother's clippers to the living room where her father was watching a cowboy movie. Though it was their usual time, she thought he might ignore her, but he stood silently and stepped into the backyard. They could talk this way over the buzz of the clippers, not having to look at each other.
"Pastor asked about you,"
her father said. The sky was filmy and light, like lavender silk rippling above her. She guided the clippers across his hair, clumps of black and gray wool falling to his shoulders.
"Okay," she said.
"The First Lady needs an assistant," he said. "Just for the summer. Nothing fancy, but it's money and you'll learn some good skills."
"I can't work there," she said.
"Why not?"
"I just can't," she said. "I'll find something else."
"It's a good job."
"I don't care. I'll find something else."
"You'll pay to fix my truck, and everything else will go to your books and schooling," he said. "It's a good job, and it'll be good for you. Spending some time at Upper Room, it'll help you. God will. You have to trust him, see? You trust him and stay in his presence, and he'll carry you through like he's carrying me."
He sounded like he was trying to convince himself this was a good idea. As if by spending enough time in church, she might absorb holiness into her bones. She sighed, brushing hair off his shoulders. What did her father know about what would be good for her? What did he know about her at all? On her first morning of work, she slumped against the window as her father guided his loaner car up the hill toward Upper Room. The church, tan with a tall steeple, rose in hills of wild brush, the worst place to be in a county that burned. Out-of-towners never ventured this far north. Anyone visiting a beach town wanted sparkling oceans and cool breezes, so they stayed downtown, strolling across the long wooden pier, where fishers lounged in metal chairs, poles propped over the edge, and children skipped with red pails to the Dairy Queen. But north of the beach was miles of coastal sagebrush that became kindling during wildfire season. In springtime, fires were distant from everyone's mind, but as her father drove, she stared out the window at black stumps jutting out of the charred ground. Even though Upper Room sat in a nest of kindling, even though it would only take a gust of wind carrying a single ember to its steps, the church had never burned. A sign, the congregation often said, of divine favor. God so loved Upper Room, he spared them from the flames. These were the stories people told themselves. She'd heard time and time again, her mother's own story about how God had led her to Upper Room. She had been a young mother then, a military wife new to California and lonely. She didn't even have a high school diploma, so she cleaned rooms at the Days Inn downtown, a job her supervisor, an older black woman, told her she was lucky to have.
"Used to be a way for us to make a living," she said. "But nowadays, they only want to hire those Mexicans. Can't speak a drop of English, but dirt cheap. Pay them right under the table. You speak Spanish?"
"No," her mother had said.
"That's all right. You'll learn."
She did, over time. Basic phrases like, "How are you?" or "Can you pass me that?" and all the swear words. Sometimes, when her childcare fell through, she brought Nadia to work with her, and the other ladies cooed over her singing Spanish lullabies as they rocked her on balconies overlooking the beach. Her mother could barely understand the songs herself, but she had heard on Oprah that it was good to expose a baby's brain to different languages. That, she would later say, was how Nadia got to be so smart. How she'd read her first book before kindergarten, stumping the other parents so much that one mother had brought in her own book to test her, convinced she had just memorized the story. But Nadia's mother remembered the Mexican women circling around her, cocooning her in Spanish, her brain sopping up words until it hung heavy and full. Her own patchy Spanish only took her so far. Her husband had been deployed to the Persian Gulf, and even though she had lived in Oceanside for a year, she had not made a true friend. So in her loneliness, she'd sought out a church home. She hadn't been sure where to begin looking. Besides the Catholic churches, dutifully named after saints, most of the San Diego churches bore nautical names like Coastline Baptist or Seacoast Community Church. With names like that, she imagined congregations filing into pews wearing swim trunks, a minister who climbed the altar with a surfboard under his arm. She tried Calvary Chapel and Emmanuel Faith, but neither felt right. Emmanuel Faith had a woman pastor who had gone to Harvard, which she'd mentioned 3 times in the sermon. At Calvary Chapel, a woman behind her had gotten filled with the Spirit and started flailing, nearly knocking everyone in the head. For years, she bounced from church to church, each one too small or too big, too modern or too traditional. Then one afternoon, she was emptying a room's trash can when a bulletin from Upper Room Chapel fluttered onto her foot. "It was my Goldilocks church," she used to tell Nadia. "I knew it as soon as I walked in. Everything about it just right." On Sunday mornings, Upper Room Chapel crowded and bustled, men in suits pulling each other into rough hugs, ladies planting cheek kisses before scribbling brunch dates on scrap paper sticking out of Bibles, toddlers skirting around flower pots in makeshift games of tag, and the mothers strutting past in colorful hats crowned with feathered plumes. Her first time in Upper Room, Nadia had watched from behind her mother's knee, mystified, as their feathers bobbed up and down past her. White gloves were pulled up to their elbows, their tambourines jingled as they walked, and she'd wondered if jingling came with age, if one day, when she was wrinkled and gray, her own steps would make music. Her mother had laughed at the question. "Oh, your body'll make some sounds, all right," she'd said, wrapping her hand around Nadia's. That first Sunday, her father had not been with them. Her mother had apologized for his absence to the pastor after service when she shook his hand in the receiving line. "My husband, he just got back from overseas," she'd said, "and he's not much the churchly type." Nadia's father had arrived home a week ago. She was 4 then, and she barely remembered him, although she was old enough to understand that was a shameful thing to admit. In the months counting down to his return, her mother had gathered Nadia into her lap and pulled out a photo album, flipping slowly past pictures of her father holding her as a baby. In one, she was curled up like a kitten against his chest, and her father, young and strapping in dress blues, smiled into the camera. He had a mole by his nose and short dark hair that looked plushy, like the bristles on her mother's makeup brush. She studied his face, searching for features that were also hers. People had always said she looked exactly like her mother. She had been wary around him at first, shy even. He'd knelt to hug her outside of the terminal, and she had drawn back, startled by this man in camouflage hefting a giant duffel bag, his face darkened by desert sun. The time she'd spent studying his photographs had not prepared her for the reality of him, his size and smell. He frowned.
"She don't remember me?"
he said to her mother.
"Well, she was nothing but a baby when you left."
Her mother gave her a little push.
"Go on and hug your daddy. Go on."
She took a few steps forward, and her father pulled her into a hug. His chest felt hard. She smiled at him, even though the hug hurt. Her father held her in his lap on the drive back home, while her mother complained that she ought to be in a car seat.
"She ought to be getting used to me," he said.
"It just takes a little time, Robert," her mother said.
"I don't care," he'd said. "I don't care how long it takes. She's gonna love me."
Now her father paused at an intersection before turning onto the road that led to the church. She hadn't been on this ride since the morning of her mother's funeral. That drive had been a blur. She'd felt like she'd been cast in a play she hadn't tried out for, and was suddenly expected to know all the lines. Would she have to speak at the service? What did anyone expect her to say? That one day she'd had a mother, and the next she didn't? That the only tragic circumstance that had befallen her mother was her own self? In the back seat of the hearse, she'd found a run in her pantyhose and quietly picked at it until it became a gaping hole, finding peace in the unraveling.
"I need you to take this seriously," her father said. "Nice thing Mrs. Shepherd is doing for you."
Maybe, but she didn't understand why the First Lady had felt inclined to help her at all. Luke's mother hated her. Ever since the seventh grade, when she'd caught Nadia kissing Deacon Lou's nephew behind the church. He was the type of boy she'd liked then, tall and rangy, draped in a t-shirt three times too big, and she'd traced his zigzag cornrows, pressing him against the side of the church as they panted into each other's mouths. She'd never kissed a boy before, really kissed him. Earlier that year, she'd dated a boy for 3 weeks, but they'd only kissed once after a circle of their friends dared them, so it didn't really count. But this kiss was a real kiss. She felt it burning through her as he slipped his hand up her shirt and rubbed her through her training bra, and she thought he might have felt it too when he suddenly pulled away, as if he'd touched something hot. Then she followed his gaze over her shoulder to where the First Lady stood. She'd snatched Nadia by the arm and dragged her back into the church, shaking her wrist as she fussed at her.
"I've never seen such a thing in my life, carrying on like that behind the church."
Mrs. Shepherd gave her wrist another good shaking, leaning her face close to hers.
"Don't you know nice girls don't do that? Don't you know that?"
She still remembered the way the First Lady's face had suddenly loomed close to hers. She had one brown eye and one blue eye, and in that moment, both became a disorienting blur. She'd dragged Nadia back to Sister Willis's class. For the rest of Sunday school, Sister Willis made Nadia sit in the back of the room by herself, writing, "My body is a temple of God," 100 times before she could be dismissed. Her mother hadn't said much on the ride home, but when they pulled into the garage, she quietly shut off the engine and sat in the car a minute, still holding the steering wheel.
"My mama tried to keep me away from boys," she said. "Obviously, it didn't work, so I won't tell you that. You just gotta be smart and you gotta be careful. Boys, they can go around careless their whole lives, but you can either be careful now or careful later. That's your only choice, really. You got big things ahead of you. Don't you give that up for nobody."
"But it's just kissing,"
Nadia said.
"Don't let it be more than that," her mother said. "Don't end up like I did. That's the only thing you could do that would break your daddy's heart."
Her father was a Marine, stoic and tough with a chest so hardened with muscle that his hugs even hurt. She'd never thought herself capable of breaking anyone's heart, let alone his. But her mother was 17 when she'd gotten pregnant. She must have known from experience how that had hurt her own parents. And if getting pregnant was the most harmful thing Nadia could do, then how much pain had her unexpected arrival caused? How much had she ruined her mother's life if her mother told her that a baby was the worst thing that could happen to her? Nadia had told Luke the kissing story once, and he'd laughed into his pillow.
It's not funny, she said.
Aw, come on,
he said. That shit was so long ago. And how you think she hates you? You never even talked to her.
I can tell by the way she looks at me.
She looks at everyone like that. That's just how she looks.
He'd rolled over in bed, burying his face in her neck, but she twisted out of his arms, feeling under the covers for her panties. She never stayed long when she visited him. It was thrilling at first, fucking in a pastor's house. But after, the thrill faded into panic, and she imagined footsteps outside the door, keys jingling, cars pulling into the driveway. Luke's mother dragging her naked out of the bed, shaking her wrist. Luke thought her paranoia was funny, but she didn't want to give his mother another reason to hate her. She had hoped someday that Luke might bring her home, not sneak her in his bedroom when his parents were gone, but invite her to dinner. He would introduce her as his girlfriend, and his mother would drape an arm across her shoulders and guide her to the table. Her father turned the silver Chevy Malibu into the parking lot, cruising toward the church entrance. She felt her stomach thrum.
I could find another job, she said, if you just give me a little time.
Go on, her father said, unlocking the door. You don't want to be late.
She had never been in Upper Room during the week, and as soon as she pushed open the heavy double doors, she felt like she was trespassing. The church, crowded and bustling on Sunday morning, was now wrapped in quiet, the halls darkened, the main foyer with its sprawling blue carpet, empty. She felt almost disappointed by how plain the unoccupied building seemed. Like how once at Disneyland, Space Mountain had stopped mid-ride and the lights flashed on, revealing that she was only in a gray warehouse, riding along a track with tiny drops that had only seemed exciting in the haze of special effects. She followed a dark corridor toward the back of the building, past the Sunday school room where she had reported, dutifully, from kindergarten to the eighth grade, past the choir room and the pastor's office, down to the first lady's office at the end of the hall. The room spread regally in front of her, mahogany furniture gleaming under the sunlight, tiny potted palm trees sprouting out of every corner. Mrs. Shepherd leaned against the desk, her arms folded. She was tall, at least 6 feet, and in her red skirt suit and matching high heels, she towered over Nadia.
"Well, come on in," she said. "Don't just stand there."
She had always seemed intimidating, if not because of her height or her title or the way she walked slowly as she talked, like a panther stalking its prey, then because of her odd eyes. One brown and one blue. The coldness of that blue eye forcing Nadia to stare at the ground whenever the first lady passed her in the church lobby.
"How old are you, honey?"
Mrs. Shepherd asked.
17,
Nadia said softly.
17.
Mrs. Shepherd paused, glancing in the doorway as if she expected a better girl to walk through it. "And you going off to school somewhere in the fall?"
"Michigan," she said,
but her response felt bare. So she added,
"Ma'am,
studying what?"
"I don't know yet, but I want to go to law school."
"Well, college girl like you must be smart. You ever work in an office?"
"No, ma'am."
"But you worked before, right?"
"Of course.
Doing what?"
"I was a cashier once in the mall, and I also worked at JoJo's Juicery."
"JoJo's Juicery."
Mrs. Shepherd pursed her lips.
"Well, look, I never had an assistant, and I never needed one. But my husband seems to think I could use some help. So let's find you something to do, okay?
She sent Nadia to bring her a cup of coffee from the pastor's office. As she headed down the hall, Nadia glanced out the window overlooking the parking lot. On the lawn in front of the church, little children played tag in the grass. Summer day camp, she figured. But she still paused, squinting as she spotted, in the midst of the chaos, Aubrey Evans. Of course, Aubrey would spend her summer at church. Of course, she had nothing better to do. She was wearing a stupid safari hat and baggy cargo shorts, and she loped slowly toward kids who scattered as soon as she drew near. She let most escape her grasp, but in the end, she caught a slow one, sweeping him into her arms as he squealed, kicking his little legs in the air. In another life, maybe Nadia could have been like her. Playing in the summer morning, scooping up a child who smiled, grateful to be caught by her. Her first weeks working at Upper Room, Nadia and her father fell into a routine. Wake early, eat silently, and climb into the loaner car. He would drop her off on his way to work. On the drive over, her father would complain about the different steering or how he hated sitting this low in traffic, but she knew he only missed his truck because while it was in the shop, he couldn't serve Upper Room. After work, he lingered in the kitchen, padding his pockets like he'd stepped inside a stranger's house and didn't know what to do with himself. Should he leave his shoes by the door? Where was the bathroom? He eventually filed outside to lift weights in the backyard, like a prisoner quietly biding his time. At work, Nadia did the tasks Mrs. Shepherd assigned her, calling caterers for the ladies' auxiliary luncheon, proofreading the church bulletin, scheduling toy donations at the children's hospital, photocopying registration forms for the summer day camp. She tried to do everything perfectly, because when she made a mistake, Mrs. Shepherd gave her a look. Eyes narrowed, lips pursed somewhere between a frown and a smirk, as if to say, "Look what I have to put up with." "Honey, you need to do this again," she would say, waving Nadia over, or, "Come on now, pay attention. Isn't that what we hired you for?" To be honest, Nadia wasn't exactly sure why the pastor and his wife had hired her. They pitied her, she knew, but who didn't? At her mother's funeral in the front pew, she'd felt pity radiating toward her, along with a quiet anger that everyone was too polite to express, though she'd felt its heat tickling the back of her neck.
"Who is in a position to condemn? Only God," the pastor had said, opening his eulogy.
But the fact that he'd led with that scripture only meant that the congregation had already condemned her mother, or worse, that he felt her mother had done something deserving of condemnation. At the repast, Sister Willis had pulled her into a hug and said,
"I just can't believe she did that to you."
As if her mother had shot Nadia, not herself. On the Sunday mornings that followed, her father never gave up knocking on her door, but Nadia always turned away in bed, pretending to be asleep. He wouldn't force her to go to church with him. He didn't force her to do anything. Asking her already required enough energy. Sometimes she thought that she ought to join him. It would make him happy if she did. But then she remembered Sister Willis whispering into her ear, and her stomach turned cold. How dare anyone at that church judge her mother? No one knew why she'd wanted to die. The worst part was that Upper Room's judgment had made Nadia start to judge her mother, too. Sometimes when she heard Sister Willis's voice in her head, a part of her thought, I can't believe she did that to me either. At Upper Room, Nadia tried not to think about the funeral. Instead, she focused on the little jobs assigned to her. And they were all little because Mrs. Shepherd, brusque and businesslike, was the type of person who'd rather do something herself than show you how. The type who would prefer to give a man a fish not only because she could catch a better one herself, but because she felt important, being the only thing standing between that man and starvation. Nadia hated how much time she spent studying Mrs. Shepherd and anticipating her desires. In the mornings, Nadia stood in front of her closet, searching for an outfit the older woman would like. No jeans, no shorts, no tank tops. Only slacks and blouses and modest dresses. As a California girl, who rarely wore anything that didn't show her legs or shoulders, Nadia didn't own many outfits that met Mrs. Shepherd's standards. But she hadn't been paid yet, and she couldn't bring herself to ask her father for money. So a few nights a week, she hunched over the bathroom sink, dabbing at the deodorant stains on the armpits with a wet towel. If Mrs. Shepherd noticed the repeated outfits, she didn't say anything. Most days, she barely acknowledged Nadia at all, and Nadia couldn't decide which was worse, the criticism or the indifference. She saw the way the first lady looked at Aubrey Evans, softly, as if a hard look might break her. What made that other girl so special? Nadia had run into Aubrey one morning outside the bathroom, both girls jolting at the sight of each other.
Hi, Aubrey said. What are you doing here?
She was still wearing that floppy hat and baggy cargo shorts that made her look like a mailman. Working, Nadia said. For Mrs. Shepherd. I do her bitch work, basically.
Oh.
Aubrey had smiled, but she seemed skittish, like a delicate bird landing on your knee. Too loud a motion, too wild a gesture, and she'd be sent flapping back into the trees. Her yellow flip-flops had sunflowers in the center, as if they were blooming from between her toes. Watching her flounce around in them, Nadia wanted to rip the flowers off. How dare she enjoy something so stupid? She imagined Aubrey Evans in the shoe store, passing rows of sensible black sandals and plucking that sunflower pair off the shelf instead, as if she believed herself deserving of every flourish. One afternoon, when the campers had gone home, Mrs. Shepherd hugged Aubrey and guided her into her office for tea. What would it be like to sit in there? Not drop envelopes on the desk or duck her head in the doorway to ask a question, but to sit. Did the pink curtains look more purple? Were the photos of Luke on the desk angled so that she might be able to see his smile from the couch? Nadia tried to refocus then on the envelopes she was stuffing, but it was too late. Her mind was flooded. Luke, the boy, squeezing between his parents in the front pew and tugging at his tie, or sitting in front of her in Sunday school, where she studied him instead of the Bible, memorizing the swirl of his curly hair. Luke clomping around in cleats after football practice, or ripping through the church parking lot blasting music that made the old folks clamp hands over their ears. Her stomach leapt. Like she'd missed a stare. Grief was not a line, carrying you infinitely further from loss. You never knew when you would be slingshot backward into its grip. That night, before falling asleep, Nadia opened her nightstand and felt around for the baby feet, a gift, if you could call it that, from the free pregnancy center after she'd learned her test was positive. The counselor, Dolores, gave her a plastic bag full of pamphlets with titles like Caring for Your Preborn Baby, Secrets of the Abortion Industry, and Can the Pill Kill You? Under a handout titled True Love Waits, the counselor had tucked a purple Precious Milestones card explaining the stages of a baby's development week by week. Attached to the card was a lapel pin, a pair of tiny golden feet in the exact shape and size, Dolores told her, as those of her own 8-week-old baby. Before leaving, Nadia had thrown up quietly inside the clinic bathroom. Then she'd dumped the pamphlets in the trash, shoving all of them through the narrow slot until she reached the card on the bottom, the one attached to the baby feet. She had never seen such a thing before, a pair of disembodied feet, and maybe the sheer oddness compelled her to keep the pin. Or maybe she had known then that she would have an abortion. She had felt her choices strung in a tight balance, and when she hadn't been able to throw the pin away, she knew that there would be no baby, that this pin was all that would remain. She had hidden the lapel pin in the back of her drawer, past old notebooks and hair ties, and an empty jewelry box her father had bought her years ago. Every night before bed, she dug through the drawer for the pin and held it in her palm, stroking the bottom of golden feet still glinting in the dark. In late spring, Oceanside was blanketed in so much mist. The locals called it May Gray. When darkened skies lasted into summer, it became June gloom. No sky July. Foggiest. That spring, the fog was so thick, the beaches were empty until noon, surfers unable to see 10 feet in front of them, abandoning the coast. The type of thick, billowing fog that rolled fat and lazy, so much fog that the ladies at Upper Room covered their hair in hats and scarves to protect press and curls on their way into the church. The fog had brought with it news. The first lady had hired a new assistant, and her name was Nadia Turner. Latrice Shepherd had never had an assistant before, and everyone doubted she would be able to keep one. She was tall and demanding, not some meek wife who sat in the front pew, silent and smiling. When the elders, and sometimes her husband, suggested she had too much on her plate, she said that she had not been called to sit, but to serve. And she served with the homeless ministry, the children's ministry, the sick and shut-in ministry, the drug recovery ministry, and the women's ministry, where she personally led outreach to the battered women's shelter. She'd grown used to the chaos of her life, running around Upper Room from meeting to meeting, stuffing clothes donations for the homeless into the trunk of her car, hopping on the freeway to bring toys to the children's hospital, to the battered women's shelter, to the youth detention center, to everywhere that needed going until she ended up back home to cook dinner for her husband. But she'd never had an assistant, and she didn't want one now.
"I just don't like the look of her," she told her husband one morning.
"You don't like the look of a lot of folks," he said.
"And am I wrong?"
"It isn't a reason to fire someone."
Behind his desk, John sipped his coffee and Latrice sighed, pouring herself another cup. Out the window, she could see the fog rolling into the church parking lot, enough to make her about sick of it. She was from Macon, Georgia. She knew rain and she knew humidity, but she hated this strange in-between, especially since springtime in Georgia
was when azaleas and peach blossoms and magnolias bloomed, and the weather was perfect for barbecues and porch sitting and driving with the windows down. But here, she could barely see out to the road. It was enough to make her more frustrated than she already was.
"Honey, we all like Brother Turner," she said, "but I don't need some fast-tailed, know-nothing girl following me around all summer."
"Latrice, the word says that the good shepherd leaves the 99.
"Oh, I know what the word says. Don't you preach at me like I'm some little woman in your congregation."
John slipped his glasses off his face, the way he always did when he wanted to make a point. Maybe some things were easier for him to say once she was blurred, out of focus.
"We owe her," he said.
She scoffed, turning in front of the window. She refused to be indebted to anyone, let alone a girl she'd done nothing but help. She had been the only one quick enough to act. That morning,